Hotline. Tell us how your life has changed since Hurricane Maria. Don't forget to say your name, where you live, and where you were when the hurricane hit. Thanks for calling.
Hi, my name is Maria J. Torres Lopez. I was born and raised in Puerto Rico, and when Hurricane Maria hit, I was here in Palm Beach, and it was very disheartening when people couldn't charge their cell phones, so we couldn't reach them. That was very difficult.
It's terrible the way that Puerto Rico is treated. I believe that it should no longer be considered a territory piece.
Hi, In the Thick. My name is Michaela, and I live in Hamilton, New Jersey. And I was at my office where I work as a water wastewater engineer when Hurricane Maria hit. And in the year since, I've thought a lot about what can I do to help the victims of Hurricane Maria. And as an engineer, I really got into civil engineering and water engineering because I wanted to serve communities that were so underserved.
These are the voices of people who listen to us, who were directly impacted by Hurricane Maria. And I just want to say, we want to say thank you so much for calling in and sharing those stories. And, you know, this is what we're talking about is human lives, right? This is not just out there in the ether. This is human lives and what has happened the year since Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico. Hey, welcome to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this is a podcast about politics, race, and culture. Welcome to the show. What up, Julio?
What up? I'm Julio Ricardo Varela. Hi, Maria.
So this is a really special show for us.
Mm.
It's a challenging show.
Yeah.
But we're talking about Hurricane Maria and Puerto Rico, and we are so honored to have with us two compañeras, serious journalists who have been working, like you, Julio, on keeping up the reporting on the impact of Hurricane Maria. So joining us from Washington, D.C. is Arelis Hernandez. She's a reporter with The Washington Post, that little newspaper from that little town. Hey, Arelis, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Joining us from Orlando, Florida, is Bianca Padro Ocasio. She's a breaking news reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. What up, Bianca?
Hi, thanks for having me.
And good morning, everyone. 6:31 on the East Coast. We're coming on the air right now because Hurricane Maria has made landfall on Puerto Rico.
The situation here is dire. We've been pounded by ferocious winds for the last several hours, and it is only getting worse. We have sought shelter inside a concrete structure, but others on this island will not be so fortunate. Authorities for days have been practically begging people in wooden structures and flood-prone areas to evacuate.
So it was a Category 5 hurricane. It devastated the island. We all saw those pictures. There was flooding and 155 mile per hour winds. It destroyed the electrical grid, left it decimated, millions without power for almost the entire past year. Still, blackouts are continuing across the country. Homes destroyed, people still living under blue tarps from FEMA, getting potable water was difficult, and this despite those recent photographs of millions of bottles of water still sitting on a tarmac in Puerto Rico 1 year later.
Right. And then there's this ongoing verification of how many people have died, which we know even the local Puerto Rican government, they kind of kept this figure dramatically low for most of this past year. But we know now that almost 3,000 people died as a result of this hurricane, and that's the official death count based on the estimate from the George Washington study that came out a couple of weeks ago. And this whole aftermath of Hurricane Maria is the deadliest hurricane in the past 118 years. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the death toll with journalist Omaya Sosa of the Center for Investigative Journalism, Centro Periodismo Investigativo, in part two of this special In the Thick episode. So stay tuned for part two of that.
Which you recorded when you were in Puerto Rico. But here's the thing about Puerto Ricans, right? Right now we know that about a quarter of Puerto Ricans' lives were disrupted by Hurricane Maria. And Arelis and Bianca, you've both reported on the ground a lot. So Arelis, I just wanted to talk about some of the recent reporting that you've done about a place called Naguabo. And this is where the hurricane hit first. And there were, your story was like incredible. So just tell us this particular place, where it started. First, where is Naguabo? And what is Naguabo seeing 1 year later?
Well, Naguabo is a small fishing town on the east coast of Puerto Rico. And it's north of Yabucoa, where a lot of my previous reporting took place. If you guys were able to see St. Luz, the digital presentation that we did. And so I knew that the eastern coast, and well, everyone knew, was where Maria came ashore. And it's some of these same communities represent some of the poorest communities in Puerto Rico. And we chose Naguabo after going through some of the poll results that we got from the partnership between the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation, looking at, you know, where people were saying, you know, that their lives were disrupted in sort of different aspects, whether it was, you know, in income and in jobs and whatnot. And, you know, through the various trips I made to Puerto Rico, people kept pointing me to Naguabo, Naguabo, Naguabo. Like, you know, Yabucoa is bad, but Naguabo is also a place that just didn't get the same amount of attention and was just as bad.
One of the things that you touched on in this reporting, Arelis, which was so painful, which was the thing that, I mean, look, if this president continues to dehumanize us, you know, what does it matter if we are suffering emotionally or with our mental health, right? So the stories about mental health and the impact post-Maria on Puerto Ricans and their mental health. And so can you just talk about, because you did this reporting, what about the mental health story in Naguabo?
Well, the situation with Naguabo is one where it seems that no part of the town is recovering, right? And as part of our polling, we looked at economy, we looked at mental health, we looked at just the general sentiment of the people. And Naguabo seemed to fit every one of these categories that we were sort of drawing from the results. Naguabo is a place where it's got this beautiful fishing pier, this malecon that was destroyed by Hurricane Maria. It's a place actually that I have ties to because it was my grandfather's favorite place to go eat fish on Semana Santa. That's also what Naguabo is known for, is going down to get fresh fish and Holy Week.
Right.
And but it also is sort of at the foot of El Yunque, the far side of El Yunque. And so you have, you know, mountains, valleys where the vaqueros are at and the dairy farms and whatnot. And then you have the malecón. And so it sort of was Puerto Rico in miniature, Naguabo. And it represented all the hardships that people are facing. You know, like a lot of people have left Naguabo. The local Sam's Club, which is actually in Humacao next door, but employed a lot of families in Naguabo, closed, leaving close to 100 families without a source of income. I followed around a fish vendor whose name is Cantalicio because he sings as he goes through the mountains selling his fish. And he talked about how, you know, he used to make $500 clean in one day selling to these mountain communities in the barrios of Naguabo and Humacao, and now he barely clears 115. And for 6 months, he couldn't work because no one had power. No one could, store the fish or and he couldn't certainly buy it from the fishermen down at the pier. And that was the other thing, too. Like, of the 22 or so fishing boats that were in Naguabo, which was sort of, a part of the culture of the Malecón area, there's only two or three left. So this is a place that it absolutely has transformed as a result of the storm.
So one of the things that you reported on is that you said that in terms of mental health, you were quoting one of the doctors, and he was saying that, the people who are coming in to the psychiatric wing, it's not like they're just having a bad day. You said, quote, these are people in crisis and on the verge of killing themselves or who are hearing voices. They are in imminent danger to themselves or others. And that there has been a spike in mental health emergencies and a cluster of suicides in April and May. This is the part where my heart just went, and most of those were adolescents. So there is a mental health crisis in particular. Is there something, an image or a story that you saw and heard on the ground about the crisis in mental health that you just can't get out of your mind at any?
In the eastern communities particularly, and this first sort of hit the news in Puerto Rico through the city of Yabucoa, that there was a sudden spike in April and May of young people making attempts to kill, I think, 11 in a span of like 2 weeks or something like that, that alarmed people and spread across the island. And for whatever reason, and I think it's probably still too early, these eastern communities are having a really tough time emotionally recovering from what happened. And these doctors, I mean, this is a clinic that was set up June 22nd, right? Not that long ago. And to have already, in 2 months, seen 100 patients who were, you know, at the edge already was pretty incredible to me. And, you know, what these doctors were telling me was this is a place that had been underserved for a really, really long time. But the trauma concurrently, right? These are also communities that also were among the last to get power. And they think that that had a lot to do with why, you know, you had folks sort of spinning out of control or, you know, whether it was for particularly for young people, whether it was boredom, it was disconnection from their friends, from their typical routines, from school. Whether it was sort of the hopelessness and the actual sort of PTSD and trauma from having gone through that storm, like the family that we profiled that lives in La Ola, the wave, which is literally a neighborhood or a lot of land that's right on the beach. And the ocean literally just came into their house and took everything. You know, you had a lot of young people that were dealing with those kinds of things and not finding ways to sort of either talk about it. In the previous reporting that I've done, a young woman named Alondra that we profiled in St. Louis also sort of exhibited this same sort of not knowing how to deal with everything that she was feeling, knowing that her family was in sort of financial crisis because of this, knowing that they didn't have power and she wouldn't be able to have, you know, access to things like Facebook or social media or whatnot to be able to stay in contact with her friends and family. Those kinds of things is what the doctor sort of explained to me could have been sort of an underlying reason for why, you know, things were bubbling up to the surface emotionally for a lot of these kids. But it's still really early. And what Puerto Rico would need, in the words of these doctors, for folks to come down and start, you know, treating these kids and also trying to research and understand what's happening here.
This just breaks my heart because I actually grew up for a couple of years in Humacao. The way you explain it, I feel like I'm transported back home. And staying on this issue, Bianca, you've also seen this firsthand with the Boricua diaspora in Central Florida, because we know that a lot of Puerto Ricans were forced to relocate after the hurricane. The Boricua diaspora has grown an estimated tens of thousands in Central Florida since Hurricane Maria. So, Bianca, about this community, what can you tell us about it? Are they building new lives in Florida? Is the diaspora coping, for example, with mental health?
Yeah, and I think I have to start with the fact that there's a lot that we don't know. We still don't have precise numbers of how many Puerto Ricans got here after the hurricane. We don't know how many people went back. And, you know, at the beginning, the way that people were being counted was through travel records. And I think a lot of us remember that because the number that was being thrown around was 300,000 people and something like that, which is, you know, it's enormous. And maybe at the end, we're going to actually see those numbers. But right now, we just, you know, tens of thousands is kind of the term that I like to use to, you know, be more comfortable. But
right.
It's saddening because a lot of the people that are coming to Florida, there's obviously all these financial and economic reasons for people to leave Puerto Rico. But at the same time, it's a climate disaster. In a way, it's kind of climate migration, right? It's people who are coming here because of this disaster that struck their homes, that affected their livelihoods. Like Aralys was saying, I've been on the ground myself, but I've also heard from people here that live on the coast and their homes were just destroyed by the ocean. And there's a lot of trauma. Mm. One of the things that has really stuck with me, I keep in contact with the students at the University of Central Florida, which actually received one of the largest or probably the largest population of Puerto Rican students after Hurricane Maria. And, you know, they talk about how politically disengaged they are. A lot of national media and a lot of, you know, politicians are kind of looking to Florida as this ground zero for Puerto Rican voters and people to register to vote and, you know, become engaged.
Wow.
Let's talk about the midterms. You've been doing a lot of reporting for the Orlando Sentinel about the diaspora and how Puerto Rican voters will or will not impact the midterm. So what are you hearing? And are we right to be focusing on this, or are we worried that actually not enough of them are engaged and are registering to vote and know where to go and understand the local elections? Which one is it?
I think it's all of the above. I go back and forth on this all the time because there's so many efforts right now. There's several organizations that have launched these. I mean, I just get weekly emails from organizations. Oh, we're launching a registration drive or a get out the vote movement for Puerto Ricans and all this stuff. But right now, we're just not seeing that happening. And it's for, you know, people are still worried about housing. People are still worried about finding jobs that can, you know, allow them economic mobility on the mainland. People are still learning English. People are still trying to find ways to recover their things from the island and bring them here. There's all these, you know, immediate basic needs that have not been filled because after the hurricane, Florida just became this, you know, very welcoming state. And it was a host state for Puerto Ricans after Maria. And, you know, hundreds, thousands of people came to Florida and just, you know, they settled here or at least temporarily. But there were all these challenges that were to come that we didn't see when we first started reporting on the issue. And one of them being housing. But on a second level, it's also educating people about what is the voting system like? What is government like here on the mainland? To begin with the fact that there are so many elections in Florida. I didn't know that you could vote in the sheriff's election. And I'm very, you know, embarrassed to say that. But it's the truth. I mean, you can't vote for any of those positions.
We love it when journalists are completely honest and revealing about their deepest, darkest secrets.
Please don't tell anybody. No, but, you know, there's all these different races and you don't have those clearly defined lines between Democrats and Republicans in Puerto Rico. People vote based on status and, you know, whether Puerto Rico should be a state or should be independent.
Julio, for our listeners who are like, wait, just can you define that?
Yeah, the major political parties in Puerto Rico are identified by the territorial status. So there's a Commonwealth Party, there's a statehood party, and there's an independence party. So it's not a traditional Republican-Democrat split. And so that's what Bianca's talking about.
Right. Yeah. So this is just a completely different system for Puerto Ricans coming here. And I actually attended a couple of educational sessions that are being hosted by local groups here on the ground just to see, you know, what kinds of questions people ask. And I was very surprised to see that a lot of people that were attending had already been in Florida for about 5 years, which was really odd because, you know, what does that tell you about the people who are just getting here? I mean, It just takes so much time for somebody to adapt to a community and, you know, for Puerto Ricans, obviously, you're citizens. So you once you are a resident of Florida, you can vote in Florida. But I've heard this comparison a lot when immigrants are coming into Florida or into another state. The process for them to become naturalized and for them to, you know, become citizens and for them to actually vote, it's a very long time and it's a span of, you know, many years. And during that time, that's kind of when their own education is happening. And I think that with Puerto Ricans, people are like, oh, well, why aren't you voting? Why aren't you going out to, you know, register and vote? But it's like, well, what can you expect when there's also this system that hasn't necessarily invested in that education for Puerto Ricans to begin with the fact that Puerto Ricans on the island cannot vote for in the presidential election.
Okay, wait. Let's take a pause and repeat that because, again, I think there may be some listeners who may not be aware of that. And, you know,
Civics 101 with Marina Hossa.
Bueno, lo que pasa es, wait a second, you guys, but you know, I'm not Puerto Rican, right? I was born in Mexico. I was raised in Chicago, but it took me coming to New York to begin to really understand the reality of Puerto Rico.
Of course.
So just to be clear, you are born an American citizen. If you are born on the island of Puerto Rico and you have the right to vote on the island for governor and for local offices, but even though you're an American citizen, you do not get the right to vote for president if you live on the island. And even if you're a member of the military and will be sent to war by the commander-in-chief, you don't get a vote for the commander-in-chief. But if you leave the island and you move to the mainland, the United States, you can, in fact, register to vote and then you will be able to vote for president. So it's a little strange.
Right. So just through all my coverage, it's been really fascinating to see the overlap between political figures on the island and political figures here in Florida. You know, they are making all these trips down to Puerto Rico and announcing them and making them, you know, really public and getting these endorsements from political figures on the island. And we just don't know how much of an impact that is going to have on the population of Puerto Ricans that has come here, because we don't know how engaged they are. We don't know what needs they have, because we just don't have that data yet.
Yeah. Arelis, what do you think? I mean, what are your thoughts about this, or what have you learned out of the Central Florida issue here?
No, it's funny. And I'm super proud of Bianca, because Bianca has the job that I had 5 years ago.
Oh, I love this.
Literally.
There is a path for Latina journalists, guys. Look at this. Yes. I just love this.
Well, yeah, no. So it's really interesting to hear Bianca talk about, you know, this community that I was embedded in for almost 4 years in trying to learn and understand. And I'm sure that Bianca's coming across sort of the same challenges and understanding, you know, what this engagement gap, right? And that's always existed. You know, Puerto Ricans have been migrating to Central Florida since the 60s and had sort of a boom in the late 70s and 80s. And mostly Puerto Ricans from other cities, right? So from Cleveland or from New York or New Jersey, who in Pennsylvania, who came down to Florida for warmer weather, including half my family. And right. It's interesting because I think the mix of Puerto Ricans and their backgrounds, where they're coming from, whether they're coming from other U.S. cities or they're coming from the island itself, makes for two completely different experiences and iterations of political thought, right? My experience is that the Puerto Ricans now who are coming from the island, not just the fact that, you know, their politics and what they're used to doesn't translate to U.S. politics or Florida politics for that matter, but also they tend to be more conservative for the most part. And their experience are totally different from, you know, the New York Puerto Ricans who've had a couple decades in the U.S., you know, might have been involved in labor movements and then came down to Puerto Rico. And I think that's where the engagement gap happens in Central Florida, is that you do have, yes, they're all Puerto Ricans, but there are these very different experiences. And I'm not sure that the political movers and the folks who organize to try and appeal to these and educate these voters are making those considerations when talking to these folks.
Hey, it's Stephanie from In the Thick. We love hearing from you, and we put out a call for your stories on how Hurricane Maria changed your life. Take a listen.
Hi, my name is Flor Frau. I live in Galesburg, Illinois. And when Maria hit, I was traveling with my father, who lives in Jayuya, Puerto Rico. My dad, 92. He is a Borinqueneer. Still, like, worry. If I can't get a hold of him, I start to freak out. You know, his land, he had many fruit trees. They're bearing zero. Well, worry about that, because he gets a lot of his food from that. It's also a huge pleasure for him. I worry about how he feels about his place. He lived a lot of his working life here in the United States, and his dream was always to go back. He's been there since 80-something, and then to see the devastation. I worry a lot about his health, like that he could get sick from the different viruses, different bacteria. I worry about the water. But there's also been some positive things, how my dad's community came together, and people caring for him once he arrived in Jayuya was wonderful for me. So anyway, thank you for everything that you guys do and all your attention to Puerto Rico.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Hey, we're back, and I'm Maria Hinojosa. You're listening to In the Thick, and with me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. We're joined by Arelis Hernandez and Bianca Padro Ocasio, all three Puerto Rican reporters and journalists. Let's get back to the conversation. So the political connection is regarding the lack of oversight and accountability, the fact that it feels like Puerto Rican lives do not matter, Latino, Latina lives do not matter, that the only way that they matter is actually if they are detaining us. So I want to move into FEMA. I want to talk about FEMA's response. Talk to me about the issue of FEMA, Julio.
It's a fact that FEMA's response was delayed, and it didn't start out great. It was totally disorganized. And when you hear President Trump, and I'm going to say it because I've been kind of angry the last couple of
weeks.
You've
been surprisingly calm, frankly.
I know, but I'm angry with a smile. But
considering,
like, people seem to forget what's happened over the year and how President Trump is basically, his response about FEMA was, it's just disgraceful. Like, the fact that he's like, we're successful, and just don't even remind me about the paper towels on his brief visit, his like 2 hour jaunt, 3 hour jaunt into Puerto Rico.
Oh, I will never forget that ever, ever, ever.
And it was also in like Guaynabo City, which, you know, for Arelis and Bianca, you know what I mean? It's like, it's not a place where the hurricane was affected. But then also the most recent denial on the updated death toll, when he basically said that Democrats inflated the numbers.
I think that Puerto Rico was an incredible unsung success.
And Governor Rosselló, finally, he said this on CBS News.
Neither the people of Puerto Rico nor the victims deserve their pain to be questioned. You know, we went through a rigorous scientific process. Therefore, that's why I decided to take the initiative to establish as the official death toll number, the 2,975, that the...
Yeah, but the question, which I've said a lot, where was the governor's pushback to Trump 2 weeks after the hurricane when Trump, he was bragging about this low death count? I mean, it took the government of Puerto Rico almost a year to acknowledge the increased death toll. And just to be clear, this was an independent study commissioned by Puerto Rico's government. And it only came after journalists were reporting about real stories of deaths. So, yeah, we know President Trump lacks empathy for Puerto Rico. And this, the recent Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation poll that Arelis mentioned, it found that 80% of Puerto Ricans think the Trump administration didn't do a good job in responding to the hurricane. The Post reports that, quote, Puerto Ricans say the lackluster response to the hurricane, which ravaged the island in September 2017, was due to a failure of government at all levels, from the president down to municipal authorities.
And of that, what we still know is that 15% of the respondents said that the response from the federal government was excellent, very good, or good. So that was 15% of people saying that.
Yeah, but 80% basically said no. So here's the question. Where's the accountability?
That's a really hard question to answer for so many reasons. I'll just take you back to the after action report that FEMA put out here, I think, a couple months or several weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the one word that stood out to me, or a phrase, I should say, was the lack of situational awareness, which is another way to say they had no idea what was going on. And exactly. I still remember like being flying into Puerto Rico, trying to get on a National Guard like transport to get over there. Finally landing in Puerto Rico, my editor said, go to wherever, you know, the officials are. That happened to be at Centro de...
the convention center.
Right. And I was there for one day and sort of, you know, got all the officials. There were like 10,000 press conferences happening at the same time, you know, in this thing where the, you know, the governor was at and all these different officials. Got a sense of who was who and what was what. And then, like, going out of my mind the next day that I was there, it's like, I have to get out of here. These folks don't really know what's going on out there. If you were just to stay in Centro de Convenciones, you would have thought that Puerto Rico had dodged a bullet and that, you know, everything was going back to normal. Because in some ways, you know, those small areas of San Juan, not even just San Juan completely, seemed a little bit normal. At least there was food being served out and, you know, catered meals being given to, you know, journalists. And they gave us tickets. I never ate there. I just thought it was just incongruous to what we were there to do.
And bottled water when there were people outside who were asking for water.
Complete, like, tone deafness and disconnect from what was happening. So as soon as I got the green light to go out into Puerto Rico, which in and of itself wasn't easy because of the gas situation and the power situation, but once you got out, you realized they really had no idea what was taking place out in places like Utuado or Jajuya, or in this case for me, it's a town that's become very close to my heart, which is Yabucoa. Right. And I had just come from Harvey a couple of weeks before. I had spent like almost 10 days in Harvey and seen how that particular disaster and the response played out. And I remember thinking on the ground in Puerto Rico, I was like, this is not the way it's supposed to work. Like, there's something wrong here. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And trying to find answers where there really weren't any to be had. And now we have a bit more of an understanding, right? Bringing it back to now in this after action report, you know, the personnel wasn't there, you know, they were fatigued. And let's be real, there are challenges to responding to an island. You know, I'm not going to sort of validate the big ocean idea, but essentially, you know, there are logistical challenges to getting certain things set up in Puerto Rico. That being said, I remember going to a distribution center with my cousin. who was running out of food. She needed a ride, and it happened to be a time where I wasn't immediately responding to a story, and taking her to a distribution center in Levittown, where my family grew up, my mom's side of the family grew up. And what they handed her was basically a store bag with two bottles of water in it, Halloween candy, and a cup of fruit for her family of four.
Oh, my God.
And that whole thing of just like, this is not what's supposed to be happening. Why does this keep happening? And this was several weeks later after sort of initial landfall. No part of this recovery. I've visited the island now four or five times. I lived there for 2 months doing reporting. No part of this seemed to go off without a hitch. You know, whether it was individuals who were asking for help to repair their homes, then came the issue of the deeds, right? Like the people didn't have the documentation to prove that they owned a specific piece of land because, you know, abuelo gave it to them.
If they needed help with housing or getting like money from the federal government, they had to prove that they owned the house, right? And they had problems with that.
Also, because like on the Caribbean, basically, like, for example, the same thing exists in the Dominican Republic. People don't have title to their land because it's just a different reality than in the United States mainland. I mean, it just sounds like a total nightmare. And I guess getting back to the accountability question, Bianca, actually, what do you do when you're doing local reporting about holding anyone accountable to this? I mean, is there a process for you? Is this one of the most frustrating things for you that you just have to deal with? That, again, if our lives don't matter, then why are they going to give an accounting to what they have or haven't done with our lives?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely experienced that while I was doing reporting in Puerto Rico, and even just doing it from here about people who, all of these situations that Aralys is talking about, they happened here in Orlando. There were people that were going through those things while they were here. So even that deed situation, I met a lot of families that were staying at hotels, that were living in families' homes and apartments here, and they couldn't prove to FEMA that they owned their home back in Puerto Rico, and they were constantly being denied. They were being told that they had to be there for FEMA to inspect the home and to give them their funds. And it was just this, you know, it was an additional stress factor. But back to accountability, it was really difficult for me to see the difference between the way that local officials from Puerto Rico were responding to my requests. There was one particular incident back in January that I reported on. There's the Puerto Rico Federal Affairs Administration. They have an office in Washington, D.C., and they have one here in Kissimmee. And after the hurricane, they were, you know, very on top of the response, and they were trying to connect people to their family members when the communications were down. And they started collecting a lot of donations, and they started getting water. And the support from Central Florida was just, it was an outpour of just donations and giving money and just blindly giving resources to Puerto Rico. And they collected a lot of donations. And back in January, there was a rat infestation in their office, and over 100 boxes of donations were spoiled, and they were never sent to Puerto Rico. And it was here in Kissimmee, and people felt betrayed. People felt like, I gave you these donations because you're the Puerto Rican government, trusting that you would give these boxes to people who needed them on the island. And it was so difficult for me to get through to the government and get a response for why was this never sent. And of course, in the context of everything else, I mean, now we're looking at these whole fields full of bottled water that were never given to people. So in that context is not huge. But at the same time, it was a local example for how people felt like,
right,
we were failed and our people were failed. And in Central Florida, that's very personal, let me tell you, because the Puerto Rican community is just so huge. Everybody knows somebody who's Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
And you're affected. It's this personal betrayal, you know, of something that should have been done by the government.
Mm.
The other part of this equation of what led to such a disaster in Puerto Rico and still kind of leaves it at risk is, of course, climate change. And maybe I shouldn't say of course, because you may have a couple of people who will deny this as a reality. I mean, we have the Trump administration pulling back on environmental regulations, pulling out of the Paris Accord. And it's in islands like Puerto Rico and in other vulnerable places that pay the biggest price of these government decisions. No one's denying that. But you also have many Puerto Ricans completely fearful of another hurricane hitting and saying that Puerto Rico is not ready. It's hurricane season right now. The United States has already experienced its first major hurricane of the season.
Yeah.
So, Bianca, what can we do?
It's kind of a catch-22 for Puerto Ricans because you just need resources either way. I mean, the climate's going to keep changing. Hurricanes will become more frequent and more intense. And this is just science, and we understand this. And I think that some people have looked at Puerto Rico as, you know, the place that is kind of showing that when you are going through a catastrophe and when you have lost everything, you need resources to rebuild. You need resources to leave as well. So the people who will thrive in place are the people who have the resources to do so, the people who have the money to, you know, rebuild their homes and complement that with loans that they can get, people who can leave and actually, you know, use their money to get plane tickets and get homes and apartments in areas like Central Florida that are, you know, the real estate is just going through the roof right now. So at the end of the day, I'm very fascinated by this question. What's going to happen to the people who are lower income families, who are in areas that are very poor, that we know after the hurricane were the most affected by access to healthcare? And I think that to a different level, but we're seeing that in Central Florida, too, and in other parts where Puerto Ricans have fled. After the hurricane, I met a lot of families that they had spent all of their savings just to buy a plane ticket to come here. And then they were here staying at a FEMA hotel. And then they were like, OK, well, what are we going to do now? I think, you know, there's a lot of criticism of that, of, you know, can we blame these people for just leaving without a plan? But at the same time, it was an emergency situation. You're looking out for your family. You have no food. You have no water. You have no power. You have no access to education. So what do you do? And I think that from just my reporting and what I've heard, there's kind of this shift in consciousness from environmental groups in Puerto Rico as well of, you know, when is this going to become a priority? When are we going to think about our source of income as the beaches and our natural resources, and how, when are we going to prioritize that to protect them?
All right, so guys, we're going to move on to our final segment, which is our temperature check.
So the temperature check is essentially a time where we get to talk about our emotions actually as journalists, because the both of you are Puerto Rican, the three of you are Puerto Rican. And so actually, I'm going to ask the three of you.
I roll with really smart, amazing women Puerto Rican journalists.
You sure do. And we're so happy that you've been on the show. And here's the thing. We've been through an emotional roller coaster over the past couple of years. And on top of that, it's the environmental disasters like Hurricane Maria. So let's start with you, Bianca. How are you personally feeling as a Puerto Rican woman 1 year after the hurricane?
I feel kind of helpless in a way. And I know, and I try to convince myself, I have these like affirmations in front of my bathroom mirror, like, you know, you're doing the best you can. You're, you know, giving voice to the people that need that voice to be uplifted. But it's really difficult. And sometimes you think, you know, who is even reading these stories? Who is caring about these lives? The day that Trump tweeted about the 3,000 lives and that conspiracy theory with Democrats, I just had to check in with all of my friends because of all the posts I saw on Facebook. You know, like, do we even matter? If 3,000 people die in Puerto Rico, does it even make a sound if they don't have representation in Congress? And just really dark things. And it gets to a point where you get so worried, but, you know, you have to look out for yourself and you have to think about the ways that you can help when you're not there.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. And it's taken me about a year to figure out how I can help.
Arelis, what about you? I mean, you're working at The Washington Post. It's pretty high powered. You're in the midst of the political dynamic and you're covering this story and you're fighting to get your story, you know, on the front page or to be covered because there's just so much other stuff that seems to take precedent. And, you know, you're not talking about your personal feelings, but how are you feeling personally about this?
I think the word that would best describe this past year would be, for me, anxious. Anxious because am I doing everything I can to cover this story? Anxious because, you know, what new piece of news? Because Puerto Rico is a place that generates quite a bit of news. What am I missing? What have I not paid attention to? Anxious because, you know, every time that hurricane forecast comes through, yeah, like earlier in September, to get those panic texts from friends and family, you know, that Isaac was forming, anxious that there seems to be so much that should be happening and is not happening in Puerto Rico. And the flip side to that, I would say, is that Puerto Rico for me has always been like magic, right? I actually talked to a photographer from El Nuevo Día before Rosello's press conference about the death study. And he said something, you know, if Gabriel Garcia Marquez had been to Puerto Rico, he would have had to write like 10 or 12 more books.
This is Macondo.
Yeah. Here, here.
Well, so the flip side of that anxiety has been just this like amazing sense of hope and reconnection with Puerto Rico. It's always loomed large in my life. My parents taught us to be very Puerto Rican, and it's always been a big part of my life, even though I grew up in Washington. To be able to have lived there, to have able to engage with folks, to be there for my family in the midst of their crisis, all of that was the two sides of the coin, the anxiety and the hope that came with the fact that no matter how many times you interview a Puerto Rican about their misery, about everything that's going on, the answer is always, you know, oh, there's always someone that's worse off than I am. Or, you know, ¿qué se va a hacer? Pa'lante, right? Like, because that's the Puerto Rican ethos. And, you know, no matter how downtrodden things really are, and sort of that's the truth of the fact that, you know, you're living under a blue roof, you have water coming into your house. Ay, pero primero Dios, you know, pa'lante, right?
We love that.
I actually got a tattoo in Puerto Rico, my first tattoo, to sort of signify my time living there and reporting. It's a pitirre, which is a bird in Puerto Rico that I'm totally in love with and my parents are not. So,
Julio, what about, I mean, we talk about this a lot offline because you're a dad, you're a full-time journalist, you know, we're so busy and we're trying to do the best that we can.
Yeah.
But I actually want to get you on the record on the show. What is your temperature check?
I remember when I called my cousin Omar, I had not talked to anyone in my family for about 5-6 days. And I finally got to him and I said, Omad, I need to get down there. And he goes, no, you're not coming down. We actually need you screaming because no one has television. No one has internet. No one has phone. So you need to stay up there. We'll get you the stories. So, you know, I just got back from the island this week and it was very special to me. It is home. I always, you know, I agree with Arelis. But if it wasn't for my cousin Omar, who I love to death, he's like my older brother. We grew up together. And he said, your work is important. It matters. You are helping us. This is how you help us. And then I finally have gotten calls from my tías and my tíos and my other primos. And they're like, what you did to tell those stories were so important. Like you guys at Futuro Media, you made us matter and we needed you guys. So I haven't had a moment, Maria, to even like emotionally like react to that. I just wake up every day and I'm like, Puerto Rico's on my mind every day. And I'm in a place to be a journalist that I can do it. And I'm very proud to do the work. And I'm also incredibly proud that we had these two amazing Puerto Rican journalists. And that's what makes me proud is that now you have a core of Puerto Rican journalists that have had a shared experience. And that's the thing that gives me hope is that Puerto Rico, we're going to keep it on the radar.
And I'm just saying the three of you are great American journalists for what you have done, for being relentless in seeking the truth and accountability. So as a fellow journalist, I just want to say, you know, thank you for being great American Boricua journalists. Arelis Hernandez, reporter with The Washington Post. Bianca Padro Ocasio, breaking news reporter with The Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much once again for joining Julio and me on this very special one-year anniversary show of Hurricane Maria.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
We really feel strongly about the reporting about Puerto Rico and our responsibility to keep on reporting about that. So please listen to part two of our one-year anniversary coverage of Hurricane Maria. And this was with Omaya Sosa and Julio Ricardo Varela speaking in Puerto Rico about the story of the death count.
And that's coming up, so be sure to listen. And also remember to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us because, you know, where else are you going to get this kind of coverage on a crisis like what's happening in Puerto Rico? It also really helps us to get new listeners. Also, please follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In The Thick Show and like us on Facebook. In The Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnham, Stephanie LeBeau, and Nicole Rothwell. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We will see you on our next edition of In The Thick. I'm so thankful, Julio, for this episode and for all the work that you have done on covering Puerto Rico.
Oh, man.
Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for your thoughts. And we'll see you next time on In The Thick. Ciao.
We'll see you guys.
Really? We're going to do this? Oh, my God.
Maria Hinojosa doing reaction lines, now playing.
Whoa. right. Oh, my God, you guys, that was so much fun.
Okay, that was the greatest thing ever.
Oh, my God,
I was like, that was perhaps, I was like,